In 2012, the top five consumer protection groups defending Wall Street reform sent 20 lobbyists to Capitol Hill. That same year, the top five finance industry groups trying to destroy reform sent over 400 lobbyists to Washington. According to Open Secrets, financial groups have spent over $1 billion to water down the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. It was signed by the president 3 years ago. Since the law was signed, the bill has been heavily watered down. On today's Your Call, we continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by talking about Wall Street reform. What, if anything, has changed since the 2008 economic crash? Join us after the news.
BBC News with Marion Marshall. The Egyptian interim president, Adli Mansour, has named a former finance minister, Hazem El Beblawi, as prime minister in the transitional government. His office has also announced that the liberal politician, Mohamed El Baradei, should become deputy president with responsibility for foreign affairs. Sebastian Usher reports.
The announcement of the interim prime minister in Egypt is aimed at trying to restore some semblance of stability to the country. The man chosen, Hazem El Beblawi, did not originally feature as a likely candidate, but the fact that he has experience as a former finance minister sends a message that the country's failing finances will be a major priority. The ousted president Mohamed Morsi's failure to get to grips with that key issue was a major reason for his downfall. It's also significant that his appointment is met with the approval of a radical Islamist An-Nur party, which had threatened to withdraw from the political process after the killings in Cairo on Monday.
The families of the Muslim Brotherhood supporters who were killed outside a Cairo barracks on Monday during clashes with the army say they're not being allowed to see their bodies. The Muslim Brotherhood, the party of the deposed president, Mohamed Morsi, has accused the security forces of a massacre. Wira Davis has been to the main morgue in Cairo.
Banging on the doors at Cairo's central morgue, angry family members demand to be let in to see and collect the bodies of those killed in yesterday's shooting. Mothers, brothers and friends sit in the baking sun, waiting as the bolted doors remain shut, and they're met by the blank stares of officials through a tiny grill. Many here told us that bodies aren't being released for burial unless they accept, without question, the official autopsy report.
A car bomb has caused a huge explosion in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, in an area that's a stronghold of the Shia militant movement Hezbollah. Dozens of people were injured by the blast, which sent large clouds of black smoke billowing into the sky. The explosion occurred in a car park near an Islamic centre. The Interior Minister, Marwan Sherbel, who came under attack when he visited the site, condemned the blast and said he was determined it would not increase tensions between religious groups in Lebanon.
I don't know what the aim of this action is. We must leave it to the criminal investigators and to the investigating judges to find out what the hidden motives are. Of course, what they're trying to do is to create sectarian strife between Sunnis and Shiites.
At least 17 villagers, including children, have been killed in a roadside bomb attack in western Afghanistan. Four others have been injured in the attack, which took place in the province of Herat. A police officer said the villagers were travelling in a makeshift motorised cart from their village to a local town when it hit an improvised explosive device. The attack is being blamed on the Taliban. You're listening to the latest world news from the BBC. The international media baron, Rupert Murdoch, is being recalled to give fresh evidence to the British Parliament because of the emergence of a secret tape recording. Mr. Murdoch was summoned to Parliament 2 years ago to answer questions about a phone hacking scandal at one of his best-selling newspapers. The three American women, who police say were held captive in a Cleveland home for a decade, have spoken publicly for the first time since their escape. In a video, they thanked people for their support and donating to a fund to help them rebuild their lives. Michelle Knight, who was held for the longest time, said faith had helped her through.
I may have been through hell and back, but I am strong enough to walk through hell with a smile on my face and with my head held high. We have been hurt by people, but we need to rely on God as being the judge. Thank you for all your prayers. I'm looking forward to my brand new life.
Their alleged kidnapper, Ariel Castro, has pleaded not guilty to charges of kidnapping, rape and murdering an unborn child. Customs officials in Kenya have seized more than 3 tons of ivory being smuggled out of the port of Mombasa. The elephant tusks were concealed in a shipment of peanuts destined for Malaysia. It's the second big ivory seizure at Mombasa this month. Elephant poaching in Africa is being fuelled by demand for illegal ivory in Asia and the Middle East, where it's used to make ornaments and in traditional medicine. Nigeria's football authorities have suspended 4 teams involved in matches that ended 79-0 and 67-0. The Nigerian Football Federation described the results in playoff games as a mind-boggling show of shame. The winning teams, Plateau United Feeders and Police Machine, went into the matches level on points and were competing on goal difference to win promotion to the Nationwide League division. BBC News.
Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On July 21st, 2010, President Obama signed the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Protection Act. This lengthy piece of legislation aimed to prevent another financial crisis. It was supposed to overhaul the banking system by placing regulatory measures in place. It was also meant to protect consumers by creating a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Nearly 5 years after the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression, what is the status of Dodd-Frank and Wall Street reform? The Nation recently ran a piece called How Wall Street Defanged Dodd-Frank, and according to the piece, in 2010, the top five consumer protection groups defending Dodd-Frank sent 20 lobbyists to Capitol Hill. That same year, the top five finance industry groups trying to destroy Dodd-Frank sent 406 lobbyists to Capitol Hill. According to Open Secrets, banking industry has spent more than $1 billion to beat back Dodd-Frank, and now that it's law, they're spending even more trying to destroy it. So on today's Your Call, we continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by taking a look at the banking system, what's really changed since the crash, and will there be another one, or will it be prevented? Today we're joined by Jesse Eisinger, senior reporter at ProPublica, covering Wall Street and finance. He writes a regular column for the New York Times Deal Book section. In 2011, Jesse and Jake Bernstein were awarded the Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting for a series of stories on questionable Wall Street practices that helped make the financial crisis the worst since the Great Depression. Hi, Jesse. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me back.
Great to have you. And we're joined by William Black, Associate Professor of Economics and Law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. Bill spent years working on regulatory policy and fraud prevention as Executive Director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention, Litigation Director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, and Deputy Director of the National Commission on Financial Institution Reform. Hi, Bill. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
And we're joined by Scott Talbot, Senior VP for Public Policy at the Financial Services Roundtable. They represent 100 financial services companies and banks. Hi, Scott. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. So, Scott, you can stay with us for about 10, 15 minutes. I want to start off with you. We have some conversations in the national media about Wall Street reform, but it doesn't really get much attention. In fact, what we hear most about now is that the banks are coming back and the profits are up again. And I'm just wondering, you know, in your opinion, when you look back at the crash, what would you say actually caused the economic crash?
Yeah, I think it was very simple, Rose. It was an over-reliance on the expected increase in home values. So instead of lenders and borrowers betting on their ability to repay the loan, everyone was betting on the value of the home going up. So bad loans were made, they were securitized, they're given, you know, bond ratings or credit ratings, and then insurance was issued to the investors. And then the home prices didn't go up. In fact, they went down. And so the whole house of cards crumbled. And no one stopped along the way to say the emperor has no clothes.
And so, you know, what about shoddy practices involved in all of that? I'm sure you've read the whistleblower bombshell, according to Salon, from Bank of America. A number of executives said that they were told to lie to homeowners, fraudulently denied loan modifications, paid staff bonuses for deliberately pushing people into foreclosure. I mean, what has changed so this type of thing doesn't happen again?
Yeah, Dodd-Frank, which we actually support in large part, took steps to address every one of those pieces and more that I just mentioned. The first is that the CFPB has issued new underwriting rules that are focused on the borrower's ability to repay. So banks can't lend money to someone unless the borrower has a demonstrated ability to repay. There's new rules relating to credit rating agencies. There's new rules relating to securitization of mortgages being sold out to investors. And there's even new rules relating to insurance. So every step along the way, and more so, have been addressed in large part or attempted to be addressed by Dodd-Frank to help strengthen the system.
When you look at what these whistleblowers said about being told to lie and deny loan modifications, how pervasive was this in the industry?
I haven't seen that piece, but it's from my experience, Rose, that's a rare instance. The industry has worked and continues to work to help homeowners through this crisis, through the economic downturn, by doing millions of modifications as well as principal write-downs. So the industry is working hard to help keep homeowners in their home and modify the loans where possible. That is the norm rather than the exception.
Bill Black, what does Dodd-Frank do to ensure that this does not happen again, specifically when we're talking about homeowners?
Well, it doesn't do very much. I agree with Scott that the relevant portion is banning liars' loans. And liars' loans were pervasively fraudulent loans made by lenders that caused this crisis. But they'll find a different loan product that does the same thing. The logic of the accounting fraud works with many different kinds of loans, so we shouldn't have any confidence going forward. Sadly, it was not, in fact, even slightly unusual, much less a rare instance, that the lenders abused the consumers in the process. The studies have shown that the problems were endemic. Indeed, when they attempted recently to study, they gave up after spending huge amounts of money because they found that the paper's work was so pathetic that it was almost an impossible task to document how bad the situation was. You know when you hit that level that you have endemic problems.
And Jesse, what would you add to that? I mean, when you look back at the crash and this Dodd-Frank bill is so incredibly long and it's been watered down, what has really changed in terms of reform?
Yeah, not much. And the problem is the analysis of the cause. Scott is right in a very narrow sense that we had a housing bubble, but that wasn't really the cause of the financial crisis. That was the cause of terrible losses to homeowner wealth and to the economy and to jobs. The financial crisis was caused because of specific, opaque, complex instruments that the banks themselves didn't understand, and they didn't understand how much their counterparts had or owned. And so when the prices of homes started falling, they panicked, they stopped lending to each other, many of them went insolvent and were saved by the government. And so that was really the crisis. So what you want to do is shore up the practices of the banks to, one, limit their ability to sell misleading products, to sell products that the customers don't understand, then also to sell products that they can't understand, that profit traders but actually put the banks at risk. And what you'd want to do is limit all sorts of practices that put the system at in grave danger. And, in fact, we did very little of that. What Dodd-Frank did not do is either remake the financial architecture of the American banking system or the financial regulatory architecture. It tinkered around the edges, and once you're tinkering around the edges, subject to enormous bank lobbying, you're not going to get a law that was very meaningful, and in fact, we don't have one.
And why not?
Well, why not? So the banks had a concerted four-pronged strategy to undermine Dodd-Frank. They pushed for delays, and we're seeing enormous delays now. Only roughly 38% of the law 3 years later is in place. That was step one. Step two was to try to put in big exemptions while the law was written. Step three is putting in enormous exemptions while the regulators are trying to write the laws. What Congress did was they passed a bunch of laws and principles of Dodd-Frank, but then left it up to the regulators, by and large, to write the actual rules. This gave the banks an enormous opportunity to lobby far out of the glare of the public, because the public just simply doesn't look at what cross-border swap regulation is going to be. And the fourth thing is that they've gotten Congress to try to introduce bills to repeal aspects of Dodd-Frank. And those are all very – oh, and, you know, and they're also doing court challenges. So that's a – it's a – sort of a four or five front war that the banks have waged against Dodd-Frank. It's vastly out resourcing the opposition and consumer groups, and you know, it's just overwhelming, and it's rendering Dodd-Frank essentially toothless.
Toothless. That's Jesse Eisinger, senior reporter at ProPublica. Scott Talbot is senior VP for public policy at the Financial Services Roundtable. They represent 100 financial service companies and banks. So, what would you say to that, Scott? Jesse covers this and says Dodd-Frank is toothless because of lobbying efforts by the financial service industries and the banks.
I would respectfully have to push back on pretty much everything Jesse said. First of all, Dodd-Frank, while it's not implemented entirely yet, it's in new territory and highly complex interrelated rules. The regulators themselves are, struggling is the wrong word, but working carefully to work through it. The industry is filing comment letters, and I encourage everyone to file comment letters. But our comment letters are focused on providing input, our view, to the regulators on what's the most effective way to achieve the new law. As I said at the beginning of the call, we are largely for Dodd-Frank, and there are a lot of provisions in Dodd-Frank that make major changes to the industry. As I talked earlier about different underwriting practices, there's new capital standards, there's new leverage standards, there's new liquidity standards. All derivatives have to be cleared through an exchange or a clearinghouse, and those are just some of the changes that Dodd-Frank made to modernize our regulatory framework. Additionally, Dodd-Frank created two new regulators, the Financial Stability Oversight Council, as well as the CFPB, to regulate the industry. And finally, if that isn't enough, Dodd-Frank also creates a system for testing the large banks to ensure that they can survive whatever the next economic downturn is. And if a bank should fail, Dodd-Frank provides a process for unwinding that bank in an orderly fashion, and this is key, Rose, at no cost to the taxpayer. So Dodd-Frank made major changes. The industry is working to strengthen and effectively implement Dodd-Frank to ensure that the new regulations, in connection with all the other regulations, don't harm the overall system, but actually work to make it the most effective way possible.
And I know we have to let you go in a minute, Scott. I just wanted to ask you a few more questions.
Sure.
I mean, what are your thoughts about just the sheer number of lobbying and the dollars? I mean, we're talking about over $1 billion that financial groups spent to beat back the Dodd-Frank bill. I mean, when you're, you know, an average citizen trying to make ends meet and you see these massive, massive numbers, you just kind of wonder, you know, why is this happening? I mean, what is the bank's end goal here when it comes to real reform?
Yeah, the end game is to implement Dodd-Frank in the most effective manner possible. There's a lot of balancing that has to go on, and let me give you a simple example. Everyone agrees that a bank having more capital means that the bank is safer and stronger, just like saving for a rainy day. So that's a good goal. However, every dollar of capital that is set aside amounts to 10 fewer dollars of loans that are made in the system. So we have to strike the right balance. Banks support higher capital standards. In fact, banks' capital is at the highest it's ever been in history, or almost at the highest it's been in our history. But that comes at a cost. And so banks, if they have money sitting in their vault, are unable to lend that. So we can all have a good policy discussion about where that right balancing point is in terms of capital versus ability of the banks to lend. And if you take that same approach to all the regulations, whether it's cross-border securities or leverage ratios or underwriting standards,
Those debates are being carried out with the regulators in public view. Everyone's welcome to submit comments. And so what we, the industry, are trying to do is implement Dodd-Frank in the most effective way to achieve the policy goals of Congress and the regulators while still helping the economy and helping ourselves to be able to serve our customers and satisfy their needs in terms of financial products and services. So all of those factors have to be weighed. It's a very complex process.
Is it worth $1 billion? I mean, can you defend this $1 billion number that the banks are spending to beat back the Dodd-Frank bill?
Well, again, we're not trying to beat it back. As I said, we're trying to make it effective. And the cost of writing a comment letter takes manpower and man hours. I don't know. I haven't seen the number. But I can tell you, as I said, we're not trying to beat it back. We're simply trying to make it the most effective that we can. And that costs money. Both sides are spending money. The regulators are asking for help. They're asking for input as they tread into new territory to implement this highly complex and interrelated system.
Do you think that Dodd-Frank will prevent another crash from occurring?
I think that Dodd-Frank will not prevent another economic downturn. Those happen naturally in our economic cycle. But what Dodd-Frank will do is strengthen the banks to be able to withstand those through higher capital and more liquidity, as well as stress tests, and then help, if an institution fails, to provide a soft landing without ripple effects that we saw back in 2008. So we can't stop the next economic crisis or the next economic downturn, but the banks will be better equipped to weather that and continue to serve the economy as well as their customers.
Bill Black, what are your thoughts on that?
Okay, so let's take it from the beginning. No, all derivatives are not required to be traded through clearinghouses. In fact, the industry is trying to get most derivatives to be exempted from clearinghouses. And in any event, the clearinghouses would have all failed, and they would have all failed immediately after Lehman Brothers went down. People can look at my Senate testimony at that on that subject, where the industry spokesperson sitting next to me agreed entirely. Stress tests existed long before this crisis. Fannie, Freddie, Lehman Brothers, all three of the major Icelandic banks, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and the Irish banks passed stress tests often within days of their cataclysmic failures. The stress tests are a propaganda exercise by the Fed and by Geithner before that, while at the Fed. No, they're not seeking to implement Dodd-Frank in the most effective manner. To do the metaphor about, okay, they're not trying to beat it back. They're trying to beat the swords into plowshares. Any provision that had any force to it will be made into an industry favorable provision. No, it is not true that simply raising capital leads to better results. We can agree on that because capital is simply an accounting residual. And if you don't fix the accounting fraud, and there's virtually nothing in the bill to fix the accounting fraud, then the capital will be phony. And no, it is not true that every dollar of increased capital equals $1 less of loans. In fact, nobody in the industry believes that. I mean, it's just terrible finance type of thing. And, you know, yes, I was a senior official at a bank. That is just the type of statement you get that has no relationship to reality. You're talking to a lobbyist with political talking points, not a substantive discussion.
Scott?
Rose, I don't know how to respond. Personal attacks have no place, but everything I've said is well documented and verifiable. Yes, we can disagree on the margins. But I think in a whole part, this is a story that works in terms of providing an accurate picture of what is happening with the banks and other financial services firms in the economy.
Hey, can I interject here?
Because, Jesse.
I want to just follow up on what Bill just said, Scott, because it's an incredibly important thing that the banks seem to be highly misleading about, and it's capital. I agree capital isn't the only solution here. But you just said that capital is set aside. You said that capital will hinder loans. lending, and you say that capital is a rainy day fund. But, of course, capital is nothing of those things. Capital, in fact, is just simply where you raise your money. You can actually raise your money from lending, you can borrow it, or you can raise it from people who buy your stock, equity. And that has nothing to do with the lending side of the balance sheet. So, in fact, what you could do is you could raise more money from shareholders. That makes the bank more stable. You could address the other problems that Bill Black was talking about. You must address those. But that has nothing to do with a rainy day fund. It's simply who is exposed to the losses. And so what you would want to do is have shareholders be more exposed to the losses in a downturn than lenders, and it prevents the insolvency of a bank. So the banks have been, this has been repeatedly pointed out to the banking lobby, and the banking lobby persists in its misleading talking points. The question is why? Why do you guys, why are you still misleading about this point?
Well, I think a couple points. Understandably, I'm sort of not saying glossing over things, but I'm not getting down to some of the weeds on some of these points, but because it's a short radio show. But when you talk about when I talk about capital, I'm including concepts like leverage ratio and liquidity ratios and other pieces that are more technical and somewhat boring. But when you add all of those together, and we saw the FDIC today raise the proposed raising the leverage ratio, that's taking real money out of the system. Yes, you can borrow. Yes, you can issue stock. But those things cost money and reduces, in totality, reduces the ability of the bank to lend. And while that is probably an overly simplistic statement, at its heart, it is true in terms of the bank trying to lend money out. Those costs associated with implementing Dodd-Frank, the costs associated with raising capital, those are all real money that also have to be expended. And that also reduces the ability of the bank to lend. So I think that it's not a matter of misleading. These are actual true statements in terms of what is going on in the economy and what banks are very worried about in terms of how all of this works out. As we try to implement Dodd-Frank in the most effective way, this is one of our major concerns, besides other concerns about the ability of banks to serve their customers, both retail and consumer, both national and international, and as well as local. The impact all of this has to be done correctly, which I think we can all agree. We can disagree about how it's done, but that's exactly what the comment periods are designed to do, is let each side weigh in and let the regulators decide what is best or how best to implement the law.
Jesse?
Well, but it's simply leverage ratio and capital, and you're talking about Tier 1 and Tier 2, where it's good to talk about specifics and it's good to talk about generalities. So if we talk about the specifics of capital, it's simply not the case that this is going to hurt lending. And no matter how many times Scott or a banking executive or lobbyist says that, it still won't be true. What you're going to do is you might reduce their return on equity. In other words, the return that they get from the amount of stock that they have outstanding. And that bank executives really like high returns on equity because they often get paid in stock. And so they maximize that, which really makes the bank itself much more risky, which means that taxpayers have that burden. All of us are bearing the hidden cost of a bank executive's high salary or a trader's high salary. It makes us much more vulnerable. So higher capital makes the banking system safer. It will make them slightly less
Jesse,
rich.
Jesse, we're going to go to break quickly, but Scott, final thoughts from you, 30 seconds?
Sure. I think that there have been new limits on types of compensation practices, which have to be discussed as part of this point. But overall, the banking system is safer, stronger. We worry about making it too safe, if you will, so you just have a large institution with a pile of money inside of it, and limiting the bank's ability to serve their customers. But overall, we're supportive of Dodd-Frank, and we're working to ensure that it's done in the most effective way possible.
Scott Talbot is Senior VP for Public Policy at the Financial Services Roundtable. They represent 100 financial service companies and banks. Thanks for joining us, Scott.
Thanks, Rose.
Thank you. And we'll be back with Jesse Eisinger, Senior Reporter at ProPublica, and William Black, Associate Professor of Economics and Law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. On today's Your Call, we are talking about Wall Street reform. What, if anything, has changed since the 2008 crash?
This is Your Call on KALW. To join in today's conversation, call 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always encourage new people to join in the conversation. If you'd prefer to write rather than call, the email inbox is feedback@yourcallradio.org. feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to talk about undercovered Supreme Court decisions. We got so much news about the same-sex marriage ruling, voting rights, a bit about affirmative action, but the court also issued decisions that will make it incredibly difficult to sue corporations and win discrimination claims. Another decision protects pharmaceutical companies against people who say they were harmed by defective generic drugs. So we'll talk about some of these undercovered, very important decisions. We'll talk about how law and society will be changed by these decisions and what they reveal about the future of the Supreme Court. Thursday, we're going to talk about the hunger strikes in California prisons. Almost 30,000 prisoners have refused to eat, and this is just growing as we speak. So we're going to talk about conditions inside prisons in California and across the country on Thursday. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our Agenda for a New Economy series, and we are talking about Wall Street. What has really changed since the crash? In 2010, President Obama signed the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, a very lengthy piece of legislation. The nation's got a long piece about, well, a lot of people do. ProPublica has done great reporting on this also, about how consumer groups are greatly outnumbered by bank lobbyists. The banks have spent more than $1 billion to water down Dodd-Frank, and they're spending even more trying to destroy it. Those are the words of The Nation magazine. And so we're talking about what has changed. And we're joined by Jesse Eisinger, senior reporter with ProPublica, covering Wall Street and finance. Bill Black is associate professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. And we have full lines. I'm sorry we didn't get to any of you to dialogue with Scott, but with three guests and this kind of issue that needs a lot of explanation, we were only able to have the three of them on. But you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Bill, what were your thoughts on Scott's comments saying that banks are safer and stronger? What does that really even mean? I mean, I had to let him go or I would have asked him to explain that.
In fact, he said his primary concern was that they were too safe. So let's back up. Remember, he said the key thing when he gave a specific that it changed was that Dodd-Frank had banned liar's loans. Right. So what about liar's loans? Why were liar's loans made and what was the industry approach to these things? What is a liar's loan? It's a loan made without verifying the borrower's income is the simplified answer to that. And we knew from studies by the industry itself by 2006, early 2006, that 90% of these loans were fraudulent. And we knew that by 2006, roughly 40% of all new loans made were liar's loans. And we know that government never required or encouraged anybody to make a liar's loan or to purchase a liar's loan, and that includes Fannie and Freddie. So, A, why did the industry make liar's loans? B, once they got this warning, Scott was completely wrong that there was no one saying the emperor had no clothes. The FBI in September 2004 warned that there was an epidemic of mortgage fraud, their words, and predicted it would cause a financial crisis. The industry, as I said, comes along in 2006, says these things are 90% fraudulent, and when they've been used in the past, they've caused huge losses to the lenders and to the public. What does the industry respond? It massively increases the amount of liar's loans and does what we call layered risk. That means other crazy things that are massively going to increase losses. By 2006, half of all the loans called subprime are also liar's loans. The categories are not mutually exclusive. And you heard Jesse earlier talk about the exotic derivative product that caused the actual loss of trust and the panic and crisis. Those were collateralized debt obligations, and they were overwhelmingly backed by liar's loans, which were the engines of this disaster. So the first question is, what have we changed that led an industry, after warnings, to make this one of their most common products? And the answer is nothing. We have not changed the perverse executive compensation incentives. There is nothing in Dodd-Frank that will get rid of them. There is nothing that will prevent the lenders from using a different kind of loan than liar's loans to produce very similar accounting fraud in terms of a disaster. And ask yourself historically, you can go back and look at the records. When the regulators were proposing to just issue guidelines criticizing liar's loans, the industry went berserk and demanded that there not even be discouragement of liar's loans. And I will time-wise go back, but ask me again about how we got to the lower capital standards, because that is entirely a story of industry lobbying in the Basel II international capital standing process in league with the Federal Reserve neoclassical economists. And that is all documented in the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission report.
Well, and Jesse, will anything come of the latest whistleblower? Actually, I should say whistleblowers. Six former employees of Bank of America have come forward to say that their mortgage servicing unit systematically lied to homeowners and denied loan modifications. And I remember 60 Minutes had an incredible piece about 2 years ago from some Citigroup whistleblowers who said they went to the federal government with documentation and the government did nothing about it. So do you think that anything will come of these latest whistleblowers?
No, I don't think so. There might be some private litigation about it. I think they came out as a part of private litigation. But that's sort of exhibit A in the argument that nothing has changed in the banking industry, because that behavior is actually post-financial crisis. What they did was, the housing market crashes, there's a financial crisis, and then many, many homeowners are struggling with their mortgages. And then what Bank of America did, the allegations are, and this has been backed up by much more other reporting, including my colleague Paul Keel at ProPublica, is what they were doing was deliberately preventing people from getting modifications. We reported that they were dragging their feet on refinancings. This is all post-financial crisis behavior. It's bad behavior that's in the short-term interests of the banks and in the long-term, against the long-term interests of the customers and the taxpayers, with the regulators either toothless, looking the other way, unable to deal with it, or actively actually encouraging this behavior because they some short-sighted view that this makes the banks more stable because they'd be more profitable. So, in fact, that's sort of the whole point that Bill and I have been making, that nothing really fundamentally has changed. And, you got Scott is as a perfect example of someone who says, we're embracing this completely. We just want to make this work well for us, and we'll deluge you with thousands and thousands of pages of technical stuff, extremely complicated stuff to try to explain to you what how this is going to, quote unquote, work better. And of course, what that means is it opens up exemptions that you can drive giant Mack trucks through that allow the banks to continue the behavior that got us into the problem in the first place.
And so at this point, the average CEO of banks got an average raise of 12% last year. Their average pay is now almost $13 million. This is according to executive compensation data from the Financial Times, spending $1 billion to beat back Dodd-Frank. I mean, how, when you think about why this is happening, Jesse, how do you answer that question?
I think that the banking sector has captured our political process. I think that there's no political will to really challenge banking power in this country. And I don't think it's more complex than that. What we did not get is any remaking of the banking system. So what now we have is the banks that are actually bigger and control more share of more markets than we had before the crisis, the economy is more vulnerable to a failure of one of these giant banks. The disclosure is so poor that we don't really know with any confidence whether they are adequately capitalized. The derivatives that Bill was referring to are so opaque and so enormous. J.P. Morgan itself has derivative exposure roughly five times the size of the American economy. All it has to do is be off by a little bit, and in fact, it was off by a great deal when in the London whale trades, where it lost $7 billion on just a handful of trades that went bad in London, where traders were trading for their own account in reckless ways. All they have to do is be off by a little bit, and that will send J.P. Morgan and the entire banking system down. So we don't really understand what their exposures are. They don't adequately disclose them. They're not overseen well, and they haven't been changed. So all the tinkering around the margins is really just that and ineffectual.
I'm going to go to calls in a minute, but Bill, just quickly, when the president signed Dodd-Frank in July 2010, did it actually have teeth? Was it a good bill to begin with before it got watered down?
No, it never had a theory of what went wrong with the crisis that was credible. It never had a strategic vision about dealing with it. It never dealt with any of the tough areas that we've gone through. It did not deal with executive compensation. It did not deal with the systemically dangerous institutions. It did not end the international competition and regulatory laxity that drives the terrible regulation. And you asked about warnings and whether they would respond. I have a piece out today in New Economic Perspectives that point out that 11,000 U.S. appraisers signed a petition over the time period 2000 through 2007 warning the federal government that there was endemic appraisal fraud, that it came from the lenders where they were inflating an appraisal. Now, think about that for 30 seconds. No honest lender would ever inflate an appraisal because it is the great protection against loss. And not only did the government regulators take no action because they were anti-regulators, but the industry took no action. So you had this, institution that Scott represents, the 100 top financial institutions, and they did nothing in response to the FBI warning that there was an epidemic of fraud. They did nothing to the 2004 FBI warning, nothing in response to the 2006 warning by the industry's own anti-fraud experts, and nothing in response to the appraisers from 2000 through 2007. This is not a question of people being fooled by bubbles. This is a fraud mechanism that makes executives wealthy, and they will desperately try to continue it.
Well, we've got a caller-related question to what you just said, Bill. Let's hear from Donald in Berkeley. Hi, Donald.
Hi, Rose. Thank you very much. And thanks for having these guests on. It seems to me that, in fact, what Bill just said is exactly the point. These people committed crimes, but not one of them has gone to jail. All they've gotten is slaps on the wrist, fines, deferred prosecution agreements. Well, here in California, 30,000 people in jail are going on strike, and probably a lot of them for lesser crimes than these folks committed. So my questions are, why is it so difficult to reinstate Glass-Steagall? Why is it so difficult to reinstate a Tobin tax, which would be a financial transaction tax? And why don't we regulate the hell out of them? Because the regulators are still essentially in the pocket of the big banks. I made a film about this called Heist.
Oh, great film. Thank you for calling in. Bill, we've talked about this many times on the show, and still no one has been prosecuted for fraud.
Well, no, none of the elites. And, you know, where the caller is, he's almost certainly within a half mile of George Akerlof's office. And George Akerlof, Nobel Prize winner in economics in 2001, in his famous 1993 article, Looting the Economic Underworld of Bankruptcy for Profit, said, this kind of fraud is a sure thing when it's run by the CEO. And he said, now we know better. If we learn the lessons of this savings and loan crisis, we need not have these future crises. So we don't learn these lessons not because we're stupid, but because powerful people, as Jesse explained, find it in the interest not to learn the lessons. And as Jesse said, the systemically dangerous institutions whose frauds caused the global crisis came out of the crisis stronger, not weaker, in terms of market share in almost all places. That meant, especially with changes in the law in the United States, like Citizens United, that their ability to establish crony capitalism became supreme. If you want a visual image of this, the next time C-SPAN shows you a hearing in front of the House Financial Services Committee, note that they had to rip out an entire section of the where the humans can view this to add an entire row for new members of the new congressional members of the committee. Why? Because they know that if you're appointed that to that committee, you will get immense amounts of political contributions. So both parties, when they get a newly elected official from a unsafe district that's really contested, they tend to appoint them to the House Financial Services Committee because that's where you can do the best in your contributions.
Well, I'd like to bring on our next guest to address this question about accountability. Bart DeZeevy practices law in Sausalito. He's previously served as special counsel to the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Hi, Bart. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Nice to have you. So what are your thoughts on this question that gets asked on a regular basis? Why has no one in the upper echelons of the banking industry been held accountable for this?
Well, it's mostly a question of willpower and resources. The Department of Justice has not applied nearly the amount of resources that was applied to chasing the crooks at the SNL crisis days back when Bill Black was riding roughshod over the crooks in the industry. And the reason those resources haven't been applied is that the Attorney General of the United States chooses not to do so.
How did things change after the Obama administration went to Washington?
Well, with respect to the bank regulatory agencies, they didn't change. John Dugan stayed at the OCC. Ben Bernanke stayed at the Federal Reserve. So folks who were hoping for change they could believe in essentially got no change when it came to bank regulatory structure. And those, of course, are the institutions that feed the referrals to the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice relies on the criminal referrals done by the banking agencies.
How much money are we talking about? I mean, when you say the department is underfunded, are we underfunded? Are we talking a million, 10 million?
Well, what we're talking about, probably hundreds of millions to recreate the task forces that were used in the strike teams chasing SNL crooks.
So, Bill, does that sound right to you, but hundreds of millions?
Yes, that's about exactly right. In fact, there were, at peak, 1,000 FBI agents working the savings and loan investigations. As I said, that crisis was less than 1/70th the size of this crisis. We have currently, which is the peak number, roughly 330 FBI agents, and they're almost all assigned to trivial cases.
So do you think that, well, do you think anyone will be held responsible, or is it at this point just done?
I think that people get wealthy.
Bart?
And the statute of limitations puts a time limit on when you can bring these cases. So Department of Justice is looking more towards bringing civil cases instead of criminal cases. And on the issue of resources, I'd like to point out something that the FCIC discovered while it was looking at the regulatory agencies, is that essentially we don't examine large banks anymore. A case in point, if you go back to the early 90s, there was a bank failure, Bank of New England, one of the largest banks at that time, and it had $30 billion in assets, and there were 110 examiners from the OCC doing the last examination there before it failed. Today, Citigroup has a balance sheet with $2 trillion in assets, and then off-balance sheet number greatly in excess of that. And when I was conducting the interview of the New York Fed regarding their supervision of Citigroup, I discovered they had 12 full-time examiners assigned to Citigroup. Now, since then, due to the unfavorable publicity, they've tripled that number, so there are 36. But, you know, it's like sending a guy with a squirt gun out to fight a forest fire and then complaining that, you know, the firefighting team isn't doing an adequate job.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up Citigroup because I almost forgot about this. The New York Times had a front page story in May about Citigroup basically writing a piece of financial legislation. And a bill, what's kind of amazing about this, it's a front page story on the New York Times. This bill is written verbatim from Citigroup, and it barely got any traction. Did you read about this?
Yeah, it's there's another wonderful aspect of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission report. People can look up free online Mr. Bowen's testimony, in which he explains how they were utterly indifferent to finding wide-scale fraud, his superiors. All the way up, he got frustrated and started copying Bob Rubin on the memos.
So we've got just a couple minutes left, and the average person who, you know, is following, there's so much going on right now, and maybe they're not completely aware of derivatives and all of these other tools that the banks are using and that are, frankly, confusing to the banks, let alone the average person who's got maybe a savings account and, you know, does direct deposit. I mean, how should the average person follow all of this and make sense of this bill? You read about the CEO pay at the banks. You read about the liar's loans. Maybe a lot of us have seen an inside job, for example. But how do you make sense of all of this?
Well, you're not going to get much of it from the largest press, although the articles are there, the analytics are not there. Jesse's work is excellent. We have New Economic Perspectives. Susan Weber has Naked Capitalism. And there are many others like this that do a very good job. But the key is we are not getting the facts and the analytics out of the regulatory agencies. When they don't bark, when they don't investigate, they don't get the facts in the record that you can cite without fear of libel and slander actions. So I would guess that even in his hometown, almost no one has heard of Bart DeZeevy, one of your guests. But we need people like him back in the regulatory ranks. Bart DeZeevy had the most incredible find in the most unbelievably difficult circumstances that blew wide open the worst fraud in the savings and loan crisis, Lincoln Savings. Bart discovered that they had fictionally created thousands of pages of documents and stuffed them into the file. This was the interconnection of Keating's frauds with Michael Milken's frauds. Milken actually controlled large aspects of Lincoln Savings. So if you want to get the facts, You have to put the Bart Zeevies of the world back in charge of the regulatory agencies instead of the Dugans and the Currys and the cast of characters that disgraced the Office of Thrift Supervision for the last 10 years.
And Bart, if you're a citizen and you want to take action on this, I mean, when you look at the consumer groups that are having a hard time trying to get any kind of meeting with politicians when they're up against these banks, I mean, what can you do as a citizen?
Well, you start with your local congressman. As corny as it sounds, you know, if enough people start sending in faxes and emails to their local congressman's office, you can at least get their attention and hope to swing the tide a little bit. It's only when these sorts of issues are the, you know, cover story on Time magazine or the lead story on the evening news about the problems at banks that individuals can hope to countervail the vast influence of the financial industry.
And Jesse, in terms of media coverage of this, what are your thoughts about where this is today? And the media, I mean, it's still important to ask these questions, but you don't see these articles on a regular basis.
You know, I think the media is doing an okay job. I think it's doing a better job than it did in the lead up to the crisis. We really failed to understand the rise of
that's a low bar, Jesse.
Shadow banking system. But we, you know, the media in general is covering banking misdeeds and does have a different attitude, I think, generally, with some exceptions, about banking misdeeds and the utility of the banking sector. But, you know, it's hard to penetrate the public's apathy about this. And these issues are complex and they get bogged down in highly technical language. So, you know, the media screamed bloody murder about the housing bubble, and it was on covers of many magazines, mainstream and non-mainstream, and the housing bubble went on. The media's power is greatly overstated in these things.
And Bill, last final thoughts from you, 30 seconds. Do you think we're going to see another crash in the near future?
Yes, we've already seen the crashes. We've already seen, at Jesse's point, these frauds post-date the crisis. We've seen a whole range of frauds, particularly in the city of London, that post-date the crisis because they won. Obviously, that should go in quotation marks, the regulatory race to the bottom. So unless and until we change that fundamentally, the systemically dangerous institutions, the derivatives, and the executive compensation, we are going to experience what we have, repeated increasing crises.
Bill Black is Associate Professor of Economics and Law at the University of Missouri and author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. Jesse Eisinger is Senior Reporter at ProPublica covering Wall Street and finance. And Bart DeZeevy practices law in Sausalito. He previously served as Special Counsel to the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And we'll definitely continue following this issue. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Thanks for listening. What do the Supreme Court's recent rulings reveal about the future of the court? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about undercover decisions. In addition to the rulings on same-sex marriage, voting rights, and affirmative action, the court also issued decisions that will make it more difficult to sue corporations and win discrimination claims. Another decision protects pharmaceutical companies against people who say they were harmed by defective generic drugs. How will U.S. law and society be changed by these decisions? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.